It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable to get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this week in our region. My guests today are Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Kevin Richert with the Idaho Education News, and Mike Sharp with KIVI Television. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Well, there's a lot going on nationally, but we got to bring it down to what's going on in Idaho because there is a lot going on. And Kevin, I want to start with you and the Funding Formula Committee meeting that happened on Monday. First, if people do not know about what happened in the meeting, can you update us and then some of the, you know, concerns that you have around this?
Well, let's backtrack and talk about what this committee is doing.
Exactly.
And why it's so important. This is a committee of 10 legislators who are tasked with the job of trying to figure out how to rework the formula that's used to carve up more than $1.5 billion of state money that goes to public schools and charter schools. Legislature hasn't tried to do this in 25 years. It's a very complicated job. So the committee met on Monday, and it was a bizarre committee meeting because the committee spent most of the morning playing around on a spreadsheet, and playing around makes it sound pejorative, but they were running different scenarios of what would happen if you tweaked this part of the formula or this other part of the formula, and how would that affect schools for the better part of the morning. And this spreadsheet is the nuts and bolts of the work of this committee and the nuts and bolts of the work of this taxpayer-funded consulting firm that is working with the committee. The catch is the spreadsheet isn't available to the public at this point. It wasn't available to most anybody in the room. You know, and I love playing with a spreadsheet as much as the next numbers wonk, and I can't do that. But it's more important than me and my fascination with spreadsheets. Education groups, the general public, they can't have access to get a sense of what would happen one way or the other with this funding formula. We're talking about $1.5 billion. We're talking about a formula that eventually, if it's changed, is going to affect the way we fund education for 300,000 kids across the state. I mean, it's a big deal. And it was just bizarre to have a hearing where lawmakers were working on a spreadsheet that is apparently not completed enough that it can be made available to the public. Well, if it's not completed enough to be public, but it's completed enough that legislators can work on it in a public meeting, I have a hard time reconciling those two.
Go ahead, Betsy.
This does kind of conflict with the approach that the legislature traditionally has taken to when a document that's being considered by a legislative committee becomes public. And they, because in the legislature, a draft bill that hasn't yet been introduced isn't yet public, but the legislative leadership has for decades had a rule that as soon as it is taken up in a public committee meeting, it becomes public. So that's how they deal with draft bills. It is a little bit surprising that they wouldn't also take that approach with this this document that is of such great interest and such great impact that was taken up in a public meeting, but it hasn't yet been made public itself.
And this is not the first time we've had questions about the transparency of this committee. Earlier this year, the consultants went around the state and held closed-door focus group meetings with educators, with school superintendents, school business managers, teachers. The idea being, let's talk to some educators who are on the ground who deal with this funding formula and get a perspective from the folks who are in this ecosystem on a daily basis. The problem is those meetings were closed to the public, and not just to the public and the news media. Members of the committee couldn't show up. State Superintendent Shuri Ibarra and her staff couldn't show up. We'll never know really what the tenor of that discussion was and how it affected what we're seeing unfold in the way of a proposal. Again, this didn't violate the open meetings law because these are meetings that were being run by a consultant, not by a state agency, but it certainly violates the spirit of an open meeting law and an open process.
And their reasoning was that it just wasn't ready?
Their reasoning then was that they wanted to have a candid conversation with educators, and their concern was that a teacher might not be willing to speak candidly about problems with the funding formula if they felt like their comments were going to get back to the superintendent of their district or what have you, that you needed a safe space, if you will, to allow educators to talk candidly about the formula. But, you know, that was their explanation. And their explanation on the spreadsheet is that it's not ready. They're tweaking numbers, and at some point they may make it available, maybe within a few days, but we'll see.
But yet they were still working on it during the meeting on Monday. They just would not release it to the public.
Exactly. And if you were in the committee room, you could see the numbers changing very quickly and get kind of a very rapid fire feel for what would happen under certain scenarios with that formula. I honestly don't know how it looked to people who were trying to watch this committee meeting as it was being streamed on public television. I really don't know. I'm not trying to be critical. I don't know if somebody could watch the stream and get any sense of what is this nebulous spreadsheet that I can barely make out on my computer screen. I really don't know. I have no idea how that played out for people.
So is there a next step or a next time they will convene, or do we even know that at this point?
Late October, they meet again. And, you know, no final recommendations have come out of this committee yet. The legislators have not yet figured out exactly what sort of proposal they're going to present. So we'll see that, and hopefully by then we'll see a spreadsheet that allows us to discern what exactly is going to mean if it were to pass.
And Mike, I want to bring you into the conversation. Talk to me about this investigation that KIVI is doing about Idaho's contracted Medicaid transportation company.
Right. So Medicaid, as its nature, is serving a vulnerable population, mm-hmm. people who don't have the funds to maybe pay for transportation. So if you have a doctor's appointment, you can contract out with the company that they contract out with or the state, which is MTM. MTM recently became the contractor for the state after there were some concerns and difficulties with VAO, which was our previous contractor. So in March, MTM takes over. And since that time, the numbers look, strictly speaking, when you're talking about rates, the numbers look really good. We're talking 0.2% as the highest number of complaints. But when you're talking about overall numbers, that's 100,000 plus rides per month, and 150 to 200 people who are just being left or not picked up for their rides at all. We got a phone call from an 81-year-old woman in Boise who had to cancel a doctor's appointment on Wednesday of 2 weeks ago because her ride just didn't show up. And so on Friday, she gets there. She gets there late because the ride shows up late. And then the ride to pick her up and take her home never shows. So she waits. She's diabetic. She waits for 2 hours in the doctor's waiting room. And when she decides it's time to just go, this 81-year-old woman tries to walk home on her own. Can't do it, ends up falling or laying down in the grass in the median of this intersection and Fort and Fourth downtown, and then can't get help. So she ends up – luckily she has her cell phone. She calls a cab driver. She has no money to pay the cab driver, but the cab driver lifts
because
her.
Because she needs the medical –
Exactly.
Yes, she needs this type of transportation.
She's in that population.
Yes.
So the cab driver lifts her into the vehicle and takes no funds to take her home because, you know, the person just worried about this 81-year-old woman. So it was kind of a personal story to tell the overall concerns that there are with the transportation system. Once again – 0.2% is a pretty commendable percentage when you're talking about rates, but anything over 1 when it comes to populations of people who are just being left at their doctor's appointments are very it's a shocking thing, at least to be that person or to be a family member of that person.
So what has MTM responded to this? What have they said about this? Because I agree, the numbers look good, but when you're talking about vulnerable population, and they cannot get to these medical appointments because there's not even a phone call saying we can't pick you up today. There's a no-show.
Right.
Go and we can't take you home.
Right. Well, what we've heard from MTM is they acknowledged that there was a miscommunication with the contractor. The problem is MTM is also contracting out with individual ride providers. So they don't necessarily have the hands-on ability to just say, hey, this person's not doing this the right way. So it's a, you know, 2 or 3 step process for them to even get the information to respond to us. But what we're finding in this investigation, and there will be more stories down the road, is that there are other vulnerable populations aside from this senior woman who experienced this. You know, we've heard anecdotes of, you know, a 14-year-old boy who was getting behavioral health, mental health counseling, who is left for 2 to 3 hours in the waiting room by himself. And it says, okay, it begs that question. Okay, so what is he supposed to do? So then are we sending vulnerable 14-year-olds to walk home because this ride didn't show up? And what's the other option? And to their credit, Department of Health and Welfare has been very open and responsive to these concerns. They have provided us answers to questions like, what's the next level or what's the next step in support for these people, which is the 211 care line, which has its own concerns and problems. So we are trying to chase as much as possible to make sure that whatever state funds are being used on a contractor, that we're using them the correct way, and we're not just necessarily ending up with the lowest common denominator, because when we put out a bid, we want the lowest bid.
So this piece already aired, but there will be more coming.
Right, yes. We're investigating more, getting more into the behavioral health and investigating to see what other types of people are experiencing these problems and where else it's happening, if it's all consolidated because of population in Boise or where it's happening and if there's a connection to specific companies that may be contracting out.
Okay. We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guests today are Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. What to talk about the latest with the racing initiative, Betsy, but also Les Bois Park. So
and the two are very much linked, interrelated,
yes,
here. And so the sponsors of the racing initiative, which would legalize betting machines at Idaho horse racetracks, are the operators of Les Bois Park. And so the five co-owners of the company, Treasure Valley Racing, that operates Les Bois Park, came out yesterday and made a really surprising announcement. They said in the future, they've formed a charitable foundation, and they're going to donate 100% of the net profits from Les Bois Park, including anything from these, quote, historical horse racing betting machines, to charity. And the reason they want to do that is to show that their motivation here was to bring back horse racing, not to expand gambling. And so to the proponents of the initiative, it seems, you know, it might seem from their perspective, this would eliminate all of the opposition, because there's been a lot of suspicion. Do they really want to bring back horse racing, or do they want to expand gambling? The problem is that the announcement doesn't change what's in the initiative itself. And so the initiative doesn't apply only to Les Bois Park. It does allow these machines at one location in each of the 44 counties that has 8 or more days of live horse racing, and at one other spot, the Post Falls Greyhound Park. Now, the Greyhound Park has never had horse racing.
Right.
And it was grandfathered in as an off-track betting parlor for wagering on simulcasts of horse and dog races in 1996, when the legislature decided that we shouldn't allow dog racing in Idaho anymore out of concern about abuse of the dogs there at that track. And so it has operated since then as just basically a gambling business. And it is written right into this initiative through a statutory reference. So the pledge from the owners of Les Bois Park, while incredibly generous, does not affect the operators of the Greyhound Park, who could do whatever they want with their machines. And among the major opposition to this initiative has been the Coeur d'Alene Tribe, mm-hmm, because there's a history there. When the Coeur d'Alene Tribe first decided to open a tribal casino after Idaho approved a lottery, which federal law said they could do, they applied for permission to the state to open it at the site of the Post Falls Greyhound Park. That is 35 miles from their reservation. It's on a freeway. It's a very busy, high-profile spot near the state line where people coming from Spokane, Washington come through. And Governor Batt at the time said no. If we're going to have gambling, it should just be on the reservation. So the Coeur d'Alene Tribe invested millions and built a big hotel and casino on the reservation, which is quite remote, 35 miles away. Now, under this initiative, a private for-profit company could open a casino at the spot they originally wanted that the state wouldn't let them, and compete with them. So it's the opposition to this measure also has come from people who simply don't want gambling expanded at all in Idaho. But the operators of Les Bois Park were very upfront about saying, we are sincere. Our motivation is about horses. It's about bringing back horse racing to Les Bois Park. They want to make it financially viable, and they're willing to put all their future profits, mm-hmm, into backing that pledge up. The question is whether that goes far enough to eliminate the opposition.
This is the first time, though, that I think a lot of us are hearing about the issue with Post Falls, which then all of a sudden makes sense with this history with the tribe.
Right. Well, I've been writing about it.
You have been.
For the Spokes Review. I mean, there's great interest in this in North Idaho, and there's tension between the operators of the Greyhound Park and the tribe. I mean, originally, I think the tribe envisioned that as the location for, mm-hmm, their casino. It's actually a place where they historically had tribal gatherings and stick games that involve gambling. And so there's a whole history there. And I don't know what it means as far as horse racing. Yeah. The the owners of LaBarre Park were very upfront about saying, we just want to bring back the horse industry in Idaho. Since they've been shut down, since they haven't been able to have those gambling machines to help kind of boost the financial viability of horse racing, they've had no horse racing at LaBarre Park since the fall of 2015. They'd like to bring it back, but it hasn't been financially viable. Is this the way to do it? This is what they're proposing.
And when LaBarre says to charity, have they said where? What types
yes,
of charities?
They did actually outline, they created a charitable foundation, and it's specific to agriculture, horse and equine-related stuff, and education. So it would be scholarships for Idaho College students who are studying agriculture or equine studies. It would be funds to help rural charities that help with health and education in rural communities. It would be funds to help families of people who are injured in agricultural or equine accidents. Mm-hmm. And they even earmarked the first $100,000 that they put into this fund right off to seed it to help Nikila Black, the jockey who was very seriously injured in Blackfoot in a race just a month ago, to help her and her family.
So they have put $100,000 already
of their money in there to start it off.
So, Kevin, what does this mean from an education standpoint then when you have something like this happen?
It's really hard to calculate. And one of the takeaways that I had from it on Thursday was that the Treasure Valley Racing folks did not try to put a dollar figure to how much could be raised and how much could go into this foundation. It's and probably rightfully so. It's probably just too early to tell.
So what's interesting to me, though, when we get back to the idea of, you know, North Idaho and it being such a huge issue between the Post Falls Greyhound Racetrack and the Coeur d'Alene Tribe, but then you bring it down to Southern Idaho and we have LaBarre Park saying this is what we'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Betsy, how could that potentially play into this being, I mean, when it comes to the ballot in November?
It's anybody's guess. I mean, I think that there's been concern about the campaign for this initiative that it's somehow deceptive. And part of that is because their initial ads that they've come out with and so on have not mentioned the betting machines. They've said, this is about horses. And there was concern when the signatures were being gathered that people who were signing the petitions were told, you got to sign a petition to bring back live horse racing. Well, live horse racing is still legal in Idaho. It has been all along. It just, according to the operators, hasn't been financially viable without these betting machines. So, you know, is everybody being upfront about what's going on here? I think that all plays into the perceptions of this ballot measure. And I have to say that had they not included that carve-out for the Post Falls Greyhound Park, I think they have a lot better shot at passing that initiative. And I don't know why they included it. I really haven't had a good answer for that.
And it's bizarre, it seems like. Mm-hmm. Bottom line.
It's included by a statutory reference, so it's not really readily apparent when you read the language of the initiative what that's about. But that statutory reference is to the grandfather clause for the Post Falls Greyhound Park.
And, Mike, the last time you were in, you talked about some mental health pieces that Roland Barris is doing, and you have another one in this series.
Right. So he's investigating mental health in the Department of Correction and mental health in our judicial system and jail system in general. So the first story that we talked about last time I was on was about the personal story of a family. The gentleman was in danger, and they could tell he was heading a certain direction, but they couldn't get help until he committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And this most recent story is kind of couched around the news of 150 more Idaho prisoners going to Texas because we don't have room in the state of Idaho prison system. A lot of the reason why we don't have room is because those beds are being taken up by individuals who may not belong in the prison system as much as they belong in the mental health care facility system. So we have spent some time talking with the Department of Correction, talking with local sheriffs, talking with stakeholders in these issues about where mental health kind of cuts off and where then you have untrained professional police officers or guards at these jails and prisons who are then acting as medical healthcare professionals because they're the only person left. And so it's an interesting look at the fact that we continue to say we don't have room in our prisons, but nobody seems to be making the effort to fund a system that would enable those people to not be in prison in the first place. And then we don't have 150 people with families in Idaho who are being sent to Texas because there's overcrowding.
How does that play into this pilot program then that's offering medication-assisted treatment for probationers and parolees?
Well, I would say that system is the goal would be keeping people from participating or falling into that trap of recidivism. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is addicted to painkillers or addicted to opioids, this gives them, I believe the drug is called Suboxone, where they use it to kind of wean people off of their addictions. So these are specifically for probationers and parolees. It enables them to have a system where they're being watched by doctors. They have a prescription for this drug. They're being regularly tested to find whether or not the drug is being used properly. And this enables them to get off the drug, save their lives, and possibly keep them from committing crimes that they were only committing because of the addiction in the first place.
Because I heard a statistic just the other day that a lot of times, just, and this is nationwide, that when someone gets out of jail, they've usually they've stopped using. But then what happens if there is not a program like this? The first time they use again, they overdose.
Right, right. And one of the shocking numbers that we found in the research we did for this story was Rhode Island has a similar program that they run. And before they started the program, 14% of all overdose deaths because of these drugs were people who had been recently released from prison. Mm-hmm. That number dropped to 6%. Just after this program. Now, obviously, you can't argue necessarily that that's direct causation, but it shows that there is some success to helping these individuals get off those drugs.
And so the pilot program is in place now?
It is. It's barely starting, right? Okay. So the goal is to get up to 50 in Ada County alone. And then hopefully when the pilot program or if the pilot program is a success, that then the conversations become, does this become statewide? Does it expand beyond the Treasure Valley?
Betsy, so let's go to the Idaho Supreme Court and what happened there just Friday, correct?
It was last Friday. There were arguments on a significant media case, and it involves a concept that an Idaho judge made a ruling on that envisions defamation by implication. So the idea there is that in this case, a TV station in Boise and also USA Today and a lot of media reported a story that was completely accurate. But the person in the story, locally in Idaho, who happened to be a teacher who had had issues with a sexual relationship with a student in another state and then came here and got a license, the teacher argued that even though it was accurate, it made him look bad. So he should be able to sue for damages. And this is an alarming doctrine. It's not one that's been recognized in Idaho law or case law. And the media entities immediately appealed to the Idaho Supreme Court, which in a very rare permissive appeal took up that issue in arguments last week. And there was an amicus brief filed by an array of media groups. And I was just looking at all the different groups that signed on. So among them were the Idaho Press Club, of which, full disclosure, I'm president, the Associated Press, the New York Times, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the Washington Post, the Idaho Statesman, Adams Publishing, owner of the Idaho Press. The list goes on and on and on. This is of great concern. Basically, truth has always been a defense against libel for reporters. And if we can be sued, even when we report the truth, because someone thinks you might read something into that, that's problematic for reporting in general. So it's a case that's being very closely watched.
So where are we in the process then right
now?
The
Supreme Court has taken its oral arguments and taken the case under advisement. We are awaiting a written ruling.
Are there any other laws on the books like this in other states, or is this...
There are some states that have increasingly started to recognize some form of libel by implication, and it's a troubling trend. Most states do not recognize it, and we're really hoping that Idaho does not become one that does.
Well, we definitely need to keep our eye on that. That is, you are right. It is a troubling statement when we think about the implications of this long term when it comes to journalism.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I want to thank my guests today, my reporter roundtable, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. It's always a pleasure to have you guys in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.